I'm much better, if you notice. By the way, all the audio is on the website. All the lecture notes are on the website. They were all updated. But anyway, if we invert and we have anything which goes to zero in our degradation model, which usually happens, then it blows up and you can get stuff like this. Because you're dividing noise by a very small number, what does it do? It effectively magnifies the noise. And that's what you're seeing here. So remember what we did was we put a cutoff on it. And we said, okay, we'll take whatever our degradation model is, and we will stop before it gets too close to zero. The idea is, since remember, it's 1 over this degradation model, you can think if you want that 1 over is multiplying the noise. So if we limit it, it won't multiply it so bad. And here, all that was happening is that we were playing with different cutoffs. And I believe that was done with a Butterworth filter. But this was with no, this by the way was just for atmospheric turbulence, and this was with no cutoff, and then 3 different cutoffs. And you can see how sensitive it is to exactly where you cut it off. Basically, this gets in as much information as possible without amplifying the noise. And what we did is that you can, very analytically if you want, come up with the Wiener filter. Or I'm sorry, with the radius. But there's a whole bunch of other classes of filters. And we tend to call these optimum filters. Oops. Because what they do is they optimize something. And the Wiener filter, we're going to talk more about what all these statistical quantities mean today, but what the Wiener filter does is, on the average, it minimizes the difference between the original image and an estimate of the image. And that's squared. And you might say, well, gee, that's pretty hard to do because I don't know what the original image is. If you stop and think about it, that is a pretty good trick. But it turns out if we can model f hat as this degradation function convolved with the original image, the idea is that we simply can base everything upon the degradation function and some statistics of the noise. And I'm going to actually review statistics in just a little bit. Up till now, we haven't really, really needed it. But the bottom line is that I can do a best estimate of a filter in the frequency domain. And it looks a little bit like an inverse filter. Notice that's the first term. 1 over H was the inverse filter. Okay, it's if the original image was H times F, then dividing it by H gets rid of the H. However, there's a second factor, which is due to all of the noise. And this is our noisy image, G. So G is our noisy image. if we would just divide it by H, that's our inverse filter. What the Wiener filter does is put a whole extra term in here, and you can see, if we had no noise, that term wouldn't be there. This would be one. It would be an inverse filter. What it is it's a filter that modulates its transfer function based upon how much noise you have. Now, what are these SNs and SFs? These are the power spectral density. Now, we've talked about that a little bit more, the power spectra, earlier. Okay? Because all this is, for my degradation function, is the Fourier transform magnitude squared. So it's still a two-dimensional thing. Okay, same thing here. But these are a little bit new to us, and this one is just simply the power spectrum of noise-free image. Now, that may be a tough thing to actually do in practice. You see, what this is sort of saying is that you need to know the result before you can get the result. You know, the power spectrum is nothing more than taking the Fourier transform of F, if I knew what it was, the noise-free image, and then I simply square it at each location. Okay, get its magnitude. But to do that, don't I need to know the original image? It is somewhat of a dilemma. Now, what you can do is you can make estimates of what the spectrum of the image looks like. And depending on what you did, it might be band-limited. You know, you might have run it through a filter beforehand. Okay? And you could say then, well, maybe I can say that for these images in general, they'll have a roll-off or some kind of frequency domain characteristic. So you can make estimates of this. Fn is the same thing, except it's the power spectrum of the noise. Now, the last time I showed you a couple images where we actually had a picture of the noise. Remember? These were the images that looked like fabric and stuff. Again, you need to know the noise. So, the problem with the Wiener filter is knowing these terms. What you can do as a good image processing, you know, computer scientist or engineer, is you can put in your best guess for each of them. But, in practice, what might be as simple as anything, this is just a, maybe we should just approximate this by a number. Instead of having it spatially dependent, that it would vary in the frequency domain, just put in a number here and try it. And that actually works fairly well. So, in fact, there's a whole body of research that's devoted to finding this term. That's actually the hard thing. So, here's some results. This is an atmospherically distorted image, that blurred image that I think we had actually back here a couple slides. Okay, atmospheric turbulence. Okay, so it's just blurred. And what we're doing is we're looking at how we're going to clean it up. And this is with the inverse filter, and to be honest, it's worse than the blurry. You can't see anything. Then here is the result of, remember what we showed when we started the class, is the radially limited inverse filter. Okay? That would be, forget this part right here, just this term, and we limit it. Because the idea is, as it's going out, it's getting closer and closer to zero. We come up with a point at which we stop. We don't want it to get too small. So we just base our calculation out to there and stop. Okay, this now is with the full Wiener term here and putting in a number here and just varying that number and playing with it. You notice that, like, when we were getting rid of noise, etc., there were occasions where we just wanted to put in numbers, try them, and see what they looked like. This is sort of like that. Now, engineers don't necessarily like to do that. They like to come up with things which are better. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. This is an interesting example, and maybe realistic, of what you might find out there. This is a combination of motion and noise. And what we do is we have the image moving down at a 45 degree angle, and we have Gaussian noise, or rather white noise, on top of that. And this is the result of, well, this is what the image looks like. Okay? This is what happens after we inverse filter it. And you can sort of see that, and by the way, this noise goes from, all of these have the same motion, but the Gaussian noise is large and decreases. This has a variance of 650, 65, 0.065. So we're going from a huge distribution, almost like white noise, to a narrower one, to a fairly narrow one. And you can see the motion still dominates, but you've got degradation and pure plain noise. Okay? So, the inverse has a lot of problems, as you can tell with this. And this isn't a whole lot of noise, right? Well, I guess it does look pretty blurred right here. You know, you want to compensate for motion, and it's got noise in it messing it up. So, here's what happens with the Wiener filter. Notice that in all cases, it does a much, much better job than an inverse filter. And you should expect that. An inverse filter is the first thing you try, and it usually doesn't work. The principle's great. If you mess up a picture, you multiply it by the inverse of the way it got messed up. The two should cancel. Noise, though, really messes up the process. That's where the Wiener filter starts to come in much better. And you can see, okay, with a huge amount of noise, constant motion, it still has problems. It's hard to read that. Now, this is much improved. This is actually not bad at all. That looks like a perfectly good image. So the idea is the Wiener filter, statistically, this idea of I want to minimize the error between an image and an estimate of the image in the presence of noise. That squared error, making it zero, seems to work. Now, people didn't like the way this worked. So they came up with other ways to do it. And by the way, let's compare this before we talk about it. Because this technique is really wild. Okay, this is now a variation on this. Imagine the next three images will fit here, here, and here. So they're the same images, but they're processed differently with something called least square error filtering. Okay? And you can see, okay, first one, the second one, actually the second one doesn't look too bad. You still see the noise, but it's readable, and the third one's really pretty clear. But I think that definitely the first and the second are better. The third one's, you can argue. You know, a clean picture is a clean picture. The way this is done is sort of unbelievable. Okay? imagine if you have a 512 by 512 image. Okay? This is all done over here by filtering in the frequency domain. Okay? For constrained least squares filtering, you convert everything to a vector. Now start to think about this in MATLAB. Okay? So I've got a 512 by 512 image. I've got a vector of length 250,000. Okay? 1,000 by 1,000. I've got a vector of length 1,000,000. These are not little matrices. So this is not, in my mind, the greatest way to do it. But if you write everything as vectors, and this would be exactly the same thing, but we're doing it in a completely different way. The original image, a degradation function, and noise. And then you get the G. It's the same G, but this is a square image. This is now a vector. And the point is, it's done completely differently. What we want to do is, that was minimizing the difference between the two. This one's something different, and you have to stop and think about it. You want to minimize the variance, okay? Actually, minimize the smoothness. I'm getting ahead of myself. And that's not a logical, necessarily, first thing for you to do. You know, why would you want to minimize the smoothness? Isn't that going to just smooth out the picture and get rid of everything and you end up with just an average? Well, not really. What it's doing is it's minimizing the smoothness of the first derivative. And if you think about noise, what does noise sort of look like in the picture? Well, think of the most obvious one, salt and pepper noise. It's big spikes. You know, it messes up the derivative. Where you had something smooth, it's not. Okay? So smoothness is actually something that's commonly used. And you have to have a constraint. And I'm not going to get into how we set up and solve these constraint optimization problems. But the constraint is this. Whoops. Yeah. I think I'm missing a square in my notes. Well, anyway, you can pose it like this. You can do all of this optimization, and it turns out that you get something that's a little bit like this, but different. And it comes out that, let's see, I guess we'll put it over here on top of this one. H and U and D, that's always known. That's our degradation function. And you're going to see that this really doesn't look that much different. G is the noisy image. F is the estimate of the image. H is the degradation function. And it turns out that and this makes sense, we were going to optimize smoothness. It turns out that what this thing is right here is nothing more than the Laplacian in the frequency domain. That's our smoothness operator. Okay. See, you can almost sort of see that there's a similarity between these. Let's get rid of that, and you'll end up that you just have a 1 over h. That, in the limit, reduces to this. This has a smoothness constraint, and again, the question is, there's a gamma here, which is the constant. How much gamma? And that's a constant that's estimated. There's a lot of math that you can actually estimate the constant, but you can also estimate it by hand. You can just try a couple different values and see what happens. And you can see that, okay, in the presence of noise, it seems to behave better than the Wiener, but is it going to be worth the computational work? That's for you to decide. You know, you might say that these are you might say it's a lot of work for not a lot extra improvement. And that's what you'd have to think about for your application. Now, here are two different images. And it turns out what they did in this case was they actually did this, and there's a procedure for finding the best value of that gamma. And they went through, and they did it with good knowledge of the noise. This is what happens, and it's not that much worse, if you don't have a good noise model. Okay? To me, I personally find either of those acceptable. But if you were publishing, you might like the one on the left. Okay? And this is now where we can clean up and finish up Chapter 5. This is actually, remember that stuff that we were doing early on in the course about image warping and stuff? This is actually where it is in GWE, although there's hardly any of it in the book. In fact, I think we're going to do 4 slides and that's it. And you've seen this before. This is simply how we relate 2 pieces or 2 grids of pixels between 2 pictures. And this just talks about different interpolation. This is the nearest neighbor. And you remember that there are other kinds of interpolation. And let's see. This just shows some examples of correcting distortion. This would have actually made a good little homework. And let's see. This one is nearest neighbor, and this one is bilinear grayscale interpolation. And you can sort of see that the edges are a little sloppier, or with the nearest neighbor, they're a little smoother. And that's basically the kind of stuff that you're getting when you use a interpolation. I really don't know if nearest neighbor is what I would call interpolation at all. You know, you're just picking the closest one. There's no smoothing, whereas there is some smoothing in the second one. And this is an interesting observation right here. This is an original image. This is a geometrically distorted image. Do you see a lot of difference between these? You have to sort of really look, like for example, start looking up here, and you'll notice that, I don't know if that's a light on a piece of cloth behind the plant or whatever, and it is distorted when you really look for it, but the key word is, in complex images, distortion doesn't look that bad. This is actually what happens when you subtract the images. Okay? And this is what happens when you geometrically correct it. You had to know how it was distorted. So, just threw that in, and I think that takes us out of Chapter 5. And what we're going to do is we're going to go off on a little tangent for a while. We're going to talk about statistics. Because if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of statistics that have been coming up in all of the discussions. Okay? We want to do one more thing with statistics that's a big deal, and that's going to be the Kalman filter. Well, I sort of waved my hands about statistics up till now, and I'm not going to do the normal probability type stuff. I'm just going to talk in general. This is interesting. If I get too much chocolate dust on my fingers, I can't operate my trackpad. Okay, we're going to go through a lot of stuff. A lot of this is definition. Okay. We're going to talk about random variables. Okay, and basically, we're going to view things as a random variable is going to be just that. It might be a there's going to be two types. We're going to do both discrete, we're going to do continuous valued random variables. Most of you are probably more familiar with discrete, because that could be throwing a dice, that could be any number of things, and the set of all outcomes will be our random variable. And I don't mean set, I mean the ordered set in terms of the measurement. That's our function of time. Okay. Now, on the other hand, maybe I have a sensor which is watching something. Maybe it's a liquid of water in a tank or something, and it's going to be putting out something, and there will be perturbations, changes in the water level. That would be a continuous variable. And in both cases, those are going to be random variables. In general, we want to think of these as functions. Okay, and that's the key thing. We're going to often write both little x and capital X. And we're going to be talking about the capital as the variable, and or the function, if you want to think of it that way, and the little x as the value. And there's a lot of definitions here. I'm not going to get into all of that because this is on the website. This is on the GW website. Okay. Now, this gets back, and by the way, I'll be very interested when we finish all of this as to your input as to whether we should have done it back when we were doing histograms rather than waiting until now when we need it for filters. Okay, because you've sort of seen these things back with histograms. We've talked about them. And we've talked about a cumulative distribution function. And remember, at that time we talked about it simply as the integral of the probability density function. Okay. And this might be our cumulative distribution function. Now, from the viewpoint of this probability and statistics, we really talk about it. It simply is the probability that whatever our variable is that it's less than some value A. And from our viewpoint, there might be our value A. And we look over here, since this is the cumulative probability, okay, that will be the probability that it's less than that value. Okay? So that's, when we say cumulative probability, this is really what the formal definition of cumulative probability is. Okay? We did it backwards with histograms. We started with the histogram and said that's the probability of each grayscale value. And then we integrated it and got the cumulative distribution function. In general, in a random variables course or a statistics course, you'll start with this and work backwards. And you'll say now, the derivative of this will be your probability density function. Now, there are properties of the cumulative distribution function. And they're all pretty reasonable statistically. At the left-hand side, the probability should be zero. Now, usually, we're not going to go necessarily from minus infinity to plus infinity. We might go from zero to 255. It depends on your problem, what you're talking about. But in general, we're talking about something which covers the whole range from minus infinity to plus infinity. At the left-hand side, the probability that something is going to be smaller than minus infinity is zero. By the time we get to the right-hand side, the probability is 1. We should have covered all of our possibilities. Okay, that's the probability that it will be less than that value. This is the probability that it's more than that value. I mean, less than that value. Okay, since it's a probability, and it's a cumulative, actually. I keep saying probability, and you should really say that's incorrect. Cumulative distribution function. Basically, it's going to go between 0 and 1 because we are talking about probabilities. When we've gotten all the way to the right-hand side, we've covered all possible values. The cumulative distribution function, the probability that's going to be less than that, okay, is 1. We're at the maximum value. Okay, here it's the probability that's less than the minimum value. That will be 0. It will go between 0 and 1 because that's the way we want probabilities to go. Or if you want, multiply by 100%. But we want them to go between 0 and 1. The way the cumulative distribution function is, since it's always the probability that X is going to be less than or equal to A, okay, that means that it is a monotonically increasing function. Probabilities always get higher as you get over here. They go down as you go over there. If you want to, you can think about it from what we were doing earlier with histograms. As I take the histogram and as I move to the right, I'm always adding something. Even if I add 0, I'm adding something. I never subtract anything because we're only talking about numbers, that is, samples. So there's never a subtraction. It's always going up. Okay? The probability that something will be between, what were they, x1 and x2, that would correspond to something like this. X1, X2, okay, it would end up being the difference between the values of the cumulative distribution function. And this is an interesting little notation right here. This says that if I move very slightly to the right, that's epsilon, this probability, if this would be f of x plus epsilon, and this is f of x plus just x, it says that those two are in the limit the same. And that makes sense also. Because remember, in the case of our histograms, we were adding things. If we're so close, we really would be adding a very small number. Now, I don't know if all of that made sense because we're doing it really quickly. Okay. Now, this is where we started. Kravenstadt works back to this. They take the derivative of the cumulative distribution function, and that's where you might get, whatever, your histogram. Okay? It will always be greater than zero. The integral of all of the probabilities will be one, because that covers all possible events. Okay? Now, we might go from 0 to 255, or whatever is appropriate for imaging. Okay? The cumulative distribution function is the integral from minus infinity to x. That's just integrating this. Okay? With the appropriate limit. But notice, everything is left to right. Okay? And, whereas the cumulative distribution function for the probability that it's between two values, okay, was the difference, because this is now the probability density function, you have to integrate between the two. Because these are all of the values and their probabilities between them. Okay. Now, we're going to primarily be using, in real stuff, the probability density function. We're still going to be using that, but we're not going to be using it for histograms when we get to 10, 11, and 12. That is chapters 10, 11, and 12. Because as soon as we finish this, we're going to go into 10, which gets into pattern recognition and stuff like that. Okay? Now, with the histogram, we really, for example, only have 0 to 255. Based on the number of pixels that have each value, that is a probability. It's not a probability density function. Really, that's what this was getting down to here when I said, if I am a epsilon away, the difference between them is 0. Okay? Because it's really tiny. But with a discrete system, there's no intermediate values. It's going to be each outcome has probability specifically associated with it. Okay? The histogram we've already done. That was way back in chapter 3. You can get into transformations. We're not going to spend very much time. Actually, we're not going to spend any time on that. You see, what we really want to get up to is this. I've been sort of throwing these things out there at you, and I'm surprised you haven't asked more questions about the expected value of a function. In fact, I had it written right over here where we were talking about the expected value between f and the estimate of f squared. And what the heck do expressions like that mean? Okay, that's what we want to talk about, because this relates to things called the variance and the covariance. If you're going to do pattern recognition, covariance and variance is extremely important. Probability density functions are very important. Because in pattern recognition, what you want to do is, in essence, you want to pick. If you don't know exactly what something is, you want to say, I think it's that with the highest probability. And that's the way we're going to approach pattern recognition. Anyway, the expected value of a continuous function and a discrete function, and really, I should be a little bit more accurate, these are for random variables. Okay? So, if we have a probability density function, this would be for a continuous function, whatever that is. Okay, so maybe it's the output of our water level sensor or whatever. Okay, and we have probabilities associated with different values. Then we integrate it over all possible, and that is the expected value. It is the mean value. If you're discrete, notice you don't have a probability density function. Each event now, we're using sub I, so these would be the different samples or different sample values, and each of them has a probability associated with it. Okay, so probabilities, probability density functions. Okay, so that's what the expected value is. It's the mean defined statistically. And this just shows that. Okay? Just put in X, okay? And the probability of X, and you get the mean. Now you can get more complicated functions, and that's what we're going to get to. Okay? But this is a definition. It's that value times its probability. Because we will probably more often than not be doing discrete. Okay? Now this leads into a whole bunch of things. Okay? Because what if you pick a different function? Okay? The most common function is pick square. Okay? And we often pick squaring because what we don't want to do is we want to simply look at the variation from a value. We don't necessarily want to look at the sign. We just want to know, is it varying? Okay, and by squaring it, we get rid of the sign. That way, positive variance doesn't cancel out negative variance. And so you'll get a much better estimate of the variability. Okay, so variance, basically, what it's going to do is, remember our probability density function, and we're going to come back and talk about that in a moment, but we've been talking about these things, and that would be our mean, it's the center, and the width is going to be our variance. Okay. Now, when it's the square, it's called the variance. Now, normally, we're going to actually want to talk about what is the variation about the mean? So a typical example that our book uses is, suppose you were talking about a target, and it might be bullets that were aimed at a target or arrows or whatever. And what you would do is you would expect that they'd be all around it. Okay? Well, if you just put in positions, okay, you would get a variance that would be related to wherever your coordinate system started. So maybe if it's down here in the bottom, you'd have a variance between here and here. What we usually do is we'll subtract off the mean. So we're talking about a function which is always shifted. Okay? So we put that at the center of our origin. Okay? Now, the next thing is, we usually take the square root of it, because when you actually plot this function, okay, the square root of the variance is the actual width. Because if you stop and think, squared function doesn't have the same distance. You've got to take the square root to get it back into the same units. Okay? So, that is what we mean by the standard deviation. If you simply remember to subtract off the mean, you're going to be fine. Now, here's where things get generalized. I was just squaring it. You can take it to any power you want. Now, I'll be honest. If you take it beyond the third or the fourth power, I have no idea why you're doing that. Okay. There are some things which, okay, the second is going to tell you the width. It turns out if you go to the third, it tells you how skewed it is. Remember when we did the Rayleigh distribution and the Gaussian distribution? One was a little bit skewed. Okay, so if I go to a cube, and this makes sense, because remember, if I go to cube, it'll keep a sense of positive and negative. Okay, so it tells me more about how much to, if it's got a bias in it. And you can go to the fourth, and it tells you a measure of smoothness. But rarely do we ever use anything beyond n equals 2. But you can get different moments. Now, this is actually a big deal. And it has an application in image processing and robotics. Okay? Because one of the things that you really get into is if you're going to look at an object and it might be rotating, you look at it from different angles or something, you'd like to come up with measures which are independent of the way that you are looking at an object to describe it. And I think we'll pick those up in Chapter 11, but I'm not sure. And these are called projections and moments. Okay? And these are moments. And this is, just to remember, central means that we've subtracted the mean out. Okay. This just talks about the target and stuff. This is the actual probability density function that we almost always use, the Gaussian. That's exactly what I drew over there. Maybe I didn't draw it accurately, but it looks like that. Okay. This is mathematically the probability density function, and it specifically includes now M, and it specifically includes the variance, or its square root, the standard deviation. Now, this is interesting. This is the cumulative distribution function for the Gaussian. There's no known closed form solution. You have tables of it, or you run MATLAB and get a value. Okay, and it does it numerically. Now, here's where we start to get up to what we need to do. How about if we're dealing with several random variables? And I'm going to step ahead and give you an example that's going to be related to stuff we're going to do. We might be looking at a picture of a moving object. Okay? That moving object might have an X position. It might have a Y position. It might also have an X velocity and a Y velocity. Okay? All of those may have a certain amount of noise in measuring them or estimating them. So consequently, you might think, okay, I've got an x velocity, that's, or rather, an x position. I'm not going to say that it's perfectly a random variable. It's a motion with a random variable added to it. Okay? You can call the two of them together a random variable. So maybe we'll have x, y, position. We'll have u, and, well, let's come up with something else, but we'll have velocities. So this is a situation where you might have a vector. And you can think of many possible things. A common one, which you will see, might be a Huff transform. Remember, a Huff transform is a completely different way of looking at a picture. And you have basically a slope and a line. So instead of having a position, you might have a slope, okay, and an orientation. So there's all kinds of different ways that you can represent your random variable. The key thing is that this is a vector now. And each of these are random variables. And sometimes they will be related to each other, and sometimes they won't. You can define a cumulative distribution function in the general sense that each one of these is less than or equal to some specified value. Like I might give you an A for that and another A for this one. Okay. But I can talk about multiple variable statistics. Okay. And you can take derivatives and get probability density functions. Now, this is what we're going to be doing in all of this stuff. Because it's a vector, I can still have an expected value. I have a probability function. Okay, I might have something now, some function right here. Okay, I don't know what it is yet. You know, maybe it's the position of something. And if you stop and think, the position of something might be a result of the previous position and the velocity. That could be two random variables. Okay, so it's easy to imagine functions of multiple random variables here. Okay, and in principle, I have one complex function, which is whatever it is that I'm looking at, and I have one big probability density function. Okay, and that is really nasty to work with. Now, some special situations. Okay, the expected values, pairs, you know, this might be the relationship between position and velocity. Okay. Because right now, we haven't said that x's are positions or anything. They're just variables. So maybe xi would be position in x. Xj might be velocity in x. In principle, you can take powers, just like we were doing with the expectation operator earlier. And I said we could do that x minus m, or x minus m squared, or x minus m cubed, or to the fourth. Well, I can take products, and I can raise them to any power. Again, in principle, this looks pretty nasty. This is technically called the joint moment. And the sum of the exponents is the order of the joint moment. And don't worry, we're not going to go to real high k's and q's. Although, it turns out that they're going to fall out. Now, don't worry, we're going to have some examples of what all of this stuff actually means. And that's not a pun. Okay. Okay, let's see. Pretty much the same thing. By the way, we'll use the symbol eta, but usually I never use that. I actually prefer just to use the expectation value. And you're going to see, in a moment, we're going to use some other symbols. Okay? Here is actually one of the most useful. Okay. Back in that previous example, previous slide, I said this could go to any power, and it's, and you see what we did was we got rid of the subscripts. Usually we're going to work with just two variables, x and y, and we'll take them to some power. The things, well, taking them to the zeroth power isn't really of too much interest, okay? Because then they'd just be ones, and you'd be summing the probability density function. But if they're both ones, we get something interesting. That's the 1-1 moment, okay? It's the expected value of x times y, okay? It's the core. This is what you always learn in your statistics courses. It's the correlation of x and y. This might be position and this might be velocity. I'm just picking something at random. Are they going to be related to each other? Maybe, maybe not. But that value is going to end up telling you how much they're related to each other. And this is fairly important. You get a new symbol, and this is what most people use, the correlation, RXY. That signifies the correlation between the variables X and Y, and it's their product times the probability density function. And, of course, integrate it. Now, what does the correlation tell you? Okay. That's just setting it up. Okay. If they separate into two pieces, okay, if we can separate the probability density function into two independent ones. Okay? We set, this is what's called statistical independence. The probability of X is not dependent on the value of Y. The probability of Y is not dependent on the value of X. The probability of X and Y is the probability of the product of the individual probabilities. Okay? And if you take a look at it, what happens then to the previous integral? Okay? If this can be written px times py, I can totally separate the integrals. Whoops, wrong key. Okay? If I can totally separate the integrals, that's the expected value of x times the expected value of y. This is when they are statistically independent. Uncorrelated. Okay? Now, we can do other moments, okay, this is the joint central moment. What was the whole idea? What was the central moment earlier? You subtract out the mean. That's all we're doing here compared to the previous thing. I subtract out the mean of X from X. I subtract out the mean of Y from Y. And I can again take them to any power. Okay? And in fact, you can get back the variances. So for example, if I would pick Q to be 0, or I would pick K to be 0, I just plug it in, that integral becomes the probability of that variable. It goes away, it's 1, and we're left with variances. Now, here's a very special one. That's the whole reason for going through all of these definitions. A couple of the low-order ones are of real important significance to us. We had the correlation earlier. Okay. The covariance is really just the first moment, U11, but it's the central moment. Okay? Because we've subtracted out the means. And this gets the symbol CXY. So it's a central version of RXY. Did that make sense? Because you've probably been using the terms correlation and covariance probably since you were in high school math courses. Okay? These are really, really important because it turns out that if you have a set of data, this is something that you can actually calculate that describes your data. And it turns out this is going to be really important for feature extraction, pattern recognition, and Kalman filtering. Okay? But you take a set of data, and maybe it's a set of position measurements. Maybe it's a set of velocity measurements. I subtract the mean of each measurement out. Now, the big problem is, for that case, I don't have any idea what the probability density function is. We're going to talk about that. And in fact, usually what we're going to do in image processing with the Kalman filter and stuff, we're actually just going to estimate this and forget all the integrals. We're just going to come up with a small number. Stop and think about it. You know, what does the variance really mean? I said earlier, it's related to basically the width of uncertainty. Imagine that I'm looking at a picture, and there's a feature maybe that's moving around, and I'm not sure where it is. You can sort of think of the variance as the circle of uncertainty. This is images now, and not anything else. You know, there would be my mean, and this might be a MX, MY. Okay, and we can start to think of the variance as sort of the circle around it in which we would expect measurements to lie due to noise. You know, this might be Dexter watching something right in front of it, and maybe because it's shaking from moving, I can't keep the road centered. This might be how the variation of the lines are just from shaking. Okay, but that's basically what we're really going to talk about. And we will not have always the nice case over there. I showed X and Y the same. They're usually not. Okay, now, how, and this is worthwhile looking at just from the viewpoint of how do you start to manipulate these things, because we're going to expect you to do that. Okay. Well, maybe not expect you too much to do this kind of stuff in this course, but this is the way you can go about doing simple calculations. And you're going to see me doing these over and over, and it's not such a big deal. MX and MY are constants. They're the means for the set of data. You know, maybe it's variation in X and variation in, whoops, I put those backwards, variation in Y and variation in X around the target of bullets or something. But just expand out the term in here. Whoops. Okay. It turns out that all you need to do is, since this is an integral, you can break it up into the expected value of each term. Remember, It would be this term times the probability of xy. This term times the probability of xy. Again, integrating from minus infinity to infinity. So we can break things up. But remember that in all cases, the expected value I guess I need to put an X and Y or something so I can complete it. But those are integrals. Okay. This term is nothing more than the expected value of xy. This term, though, that's just a constant. The constant can be taken outside the integral. So it's minus mx, the expected value of y. This now, same thing, minus my, expected value of x. This is nothing more. What's the expected value of a constant? There's no variation. It's not going anywhere. There's no randomness. Because you pull the mxmy out, it's the integral of the probability density function, which is 1. Okay? So these are the kinds of operations that you can do. Because this is a nice integral, you can separate terms. The standard thing that we're going to do next time in the Kalman filter is we're going to take some terms like this. We're going to multiply them out. They'll separate into terms, and we're going to do some things with them. Actually, Kalman filter is, it does something which is completely different than anything that we've done before. And that's why we're sort of leading up to it. It's recursive. This is a big deal. For the people that are into systems and filters and stuff, what we mean by that is I'm going to take maybe the last three estimates. Maybe not all of them, just the last three. Okay? But I'm going to contain knowledge of all of the previous ones that came before in those three. Okay? What it is I don't want to, you know, if this is like my millionth observation, I don't want to do a million calculations, okay? I want to keep the size of my computation small. And it turns out you can do some really, 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 really cool things with a Kalman filter. Kalman filters are used, well, we'll get into it, but basically smoothing, interpolation, and extrapolation, which means prediction. And that's the kind of thing, actually, in all of those, we're going to be very interested in them. And you'll see Kalman filters all over the place these days. And in fact, computer scientists are publishing more of the work about Kalman filters than electrical engineers are. And I don't know if systems and control people, you know, this is probably not, well, in the grand scheme of things, they're probably not publishing as much as the computer scientists. Kalman filters are used for things like if you've seen the pictures of people wearing LEDs on their head or having LEDs on their body parts. You can have multiple cameras that estimates the pose of things. Dexter, I believe, has a Kalman filter which integrates the inertial navigation system with the GPS measurements. Kalman filters are used for a lot of things. And actually, I'm going to show you a very simple example next time of Kalman filters. It's called curve fitting. Turns out when you fit a straight line to a bunch of data, that's a very simple Kalman filter. Okay, but we're going to relate it to these things, expected values. So we're going to have some data, we calculate some properties of the data, and from that we can do really, really cool things like curve fitting or predicting. Okay. On 2. until next time.